Good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's Hidden Sparks Without Walls presentation. My name is Alicia Huss, and I'm the Director of School Services at Hidden Sparks and host for tonight's webinar. I'm grateful that we have Dr. Rona Novick with us this evening to discuss supporting healthy friendships. Can you help your child make and keep good friends? As always, throughout the presentation, we encourage you to contribute your comments and questions via the chat. If you'd like the whole group to see your comments, please be sure to chat to everyone. Otherwise, you can direct your question to me to have your question addressed. A full recording of tonight's webinar will be available in about a week. I'll let you know when it's posted and you can share it with friends. While I introduce Dr. Novick, please pop your location in the chat so we can see where everyone is zooming in from. Rona Milch-Novick, PhD, is the Dean Emerita of the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at Yeshiva University. Prior to serving as Dean, she was the Director of the Doctoral Program in Jewish Educational Leadership and Innovation. Dr. Novick is also the Co-Educational Director of Hidden Sparks. A clinical psychologist, Dr. Novick also served as the Chief of Child Psychology and Director of Training at Schneider Children's Hospital. Well known for her academic writing and presentations, she's also a frequent presenter for parent, school, and synagogue groups. Her areas of expertise include cognitive behavioral therapy, positive psychology, trauma, bully prevention, and parenting. She's the author of two children's books published by Berman House. Dr. Novick is a firm believer in the unending capacity for all of us to grow and change. Dr. Novick, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. If you could move the slides forward for me, Rabbi. What we're going to do tonight is talk about how important friendships are, as if we didn't know that as parents, but also talk about developmental and temperamental considerations for our children. And I want to really focus on how we as parents have specific roles and opportunities that can build our children's friendships and preserve them and grow them through what we value, how we live, and what we teach. Next slide, please. We can go on to the next one. It's clear. Friendships matter. We know that as parents because there's nothing worse than a child who comes home from school or camp or a weekend get together and is not happy because things did not go well socially. But psychologists and researchers have found that friendships matter in so many ways. They clearly benefit children's development, but friendships also provide insulation for life's challenges. And by the way, if you don't have a friend, go get one because adult friendships help us live longer and be healthier. Research is really clear on this. Friendships matter and they make a difference. So we want to give the gift of friendship whenever we can to our children. But it's one of those things that we can't mandate. We can't control other children, and we can't force our children to make friends or be friends. So, how can we play a role? Next slide, please. I want us to keep in mind as we talk today that friendship matters, but friendliness matters too. Not everyone in your child's life will be a friend, but your child can be friendly and expect friendliness from everyone. Friendliness, civility, social niceties contribute to us living and being part of a caring, welcoming social environment, and it benefits everyone who lives in it. Think about times when you yourself were in a community that felt where everyone was welcome and everyone was friendly. And think how wonderful and comfortable and safe that felt. And compare it to a place when you walk into a room and you feel like, am I really welcome here? Am I on the outs with people? And how uncomfortable that feels. Next slide, please. Some facts about friendship that we know from research and from developmental understanding. We know that children need one or two good friendships. They do not need popularity. They do not need to be belle of the ball, social butterfly, but they do benefit from having one or two good friendships. And many children, by about second or third grade, will identify a best friend, someone they consider their best friend. That may change over time. It may not be the same person through their life, but having those few close friendships is important. We have to keep in mind that the nature of friendship, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in a moment, changes dramatically over childhood years. The way a kindergartner thinks about friendship is vastly different than how a middle schooler, a teenager, and an adult thinks about friendship. And another thing to keep in mind is that making and keeping friends depends on some amount of luck, of being in the right place with the right kinds of people. And it also requires a large amount of social skills. Families can create some of that luck. You can help put your child in those places or teen where they're likely to find a fertile social environment. And families can contribute in a large amount to their children's and their teens' social skill development. We could have the next slide. So let's think about what friendship looks like for different age children. And I love the geographic diversity that I saw on the chat. I'd also love people to take a moment and post in the chat the age of or ages of your children, from youngest to oldest, the range of your children. And I suspect that we have a great deal of diversity there as well. In preschool, friendships are transitory and they're based on the moment and on geography. Literally, you sit next to me, you're my best friend. Preschoolers will literally say, well, Yessi isn't my friend anymore because he's not in my class. No matter how much they like Yessi and they see Yessi. Or they'll say, Shira is my friend. She gave me a lollipop. Friendship is in the moment in preschool. That means good news is it could be bad today and great tomorrow. The bad news is th that's good news, but it's also bad news, and it's very fickle. A child can have someone that they think of as their friend one moment, and tomorrow that friend sits somewhere else, and they are now convinced that person's not my friend. As children move into their elementary school years, they begin to understand that friends are people who have something in common with us, who have some mutual interest. We both like playing with cars or Legos. We both like make believe. Elementary school begins the idea that friendships have some permanence to them, that they transcend the moment, that even though she's not in my third grade class, he's not my science fair buddy, we're still friends. And often in elementary school is when children develop this concept of this is my best friend. In the early teen years, the peer group, not just individual peers, but the group becomes critically important. Children feel this need to fit in and to belong. Friendships at this point can survive distance, and they can become quite enduring, especially in our very connected age where children, teens can have access through social media to staying in touch with friends even at a distance. But in the early teen years, friendships can also be volatile. They can also have cutoffs and angry, resentful, cooling off periods. In the teen years, peers remain important, but teens are better able to separate themselves from the group and recognize that this may be a group that's important to me, but I can also be my own person. In teen years, the concept of what a friend is becomes really important for healthy friendships. And I have to say, I've been very distressed recently in recent years in some of my visits to middle schools and high schools, where adolescents have described for me their concept of friendship, which really sounds to me like ownership or slavery. In other words, if she's my friend, she will not get together with other people. It's exclusive. That's not friendship, that's ownership. If she's my friend, she would include me in everything. That's not friendship. That is a demand that's unreasonable. So one of the things we can do as our children age is help them understand what friendship is, what friendship isn't. And in the same way, we can help them understand what being friendly means, what being civic and socially welcoming means. Next slide, please. Now, age isn't the only factor that will influence our child's social life and their friendships. Children come, if you have more than one child, you know this. Children come at birth with a pre-existing set of dials. Their temperament is set. We know that there are children in the nursery, in the hospital nursery, who, when they're upset, sound like this. Little tiny cries. And there are children who, when they're upset, are red in the face and screaming, waking up all the other babies. That's a temperamental setting that comes with your child at birth. We all know if we're blessed with a child who the world just rolls off their shoulder versus a child who is hypersensitive and gets annoyed at every little thing. We know that it's hard to, when you're asking a child to change, to push up against their temperament. One of the temperamental factors that children come kind of with a preset is how much social engagement they need or want. Some of us are more naturally shy and like alone time. I spoke to a parent recently whose teenage daughter would like nothing more than to spend Shabbat reading, curled up with a book. Whereas her peer group is busy flitting around and having endless social get-togethers on Shabbat afternoon. She's not comfortable. She's never going to want to do that amount of flitting. Now we can talk about how do we help that very reserved, shy, loves to be alone child engage a little bit more. But we have to respect that she is not going to be the social butterfly. We also have to think about what type of social interaction is most comfortable given our child's temperament. Do they love a room filled with tons of people, lots of noise, lots of emotion, or do they like things smaller and more contained? Here we consider things like shyness, like how much a child likes novelty, likes to try things new and take risk, and emotional intensity, that difference between those two babies in the nursery, a child who gets, or a teen who gets just a little bit upset versus a child who can get very, very emotionally distressed by things that happen. All of these factors are going to play into how we help support our children's friendships. Next slide, please. I want to suggest that we embrace what I call the kosher BLT. Instead of the bacon, lettuce, and tomato, it's value, live, and teach. I have a bad memory, so I need an acronym to remember anything. Value, live, and teach. What do I mean here? These three components are absolutely critical to help support our children's social growth. The first is value. Do you value social interactions and friendships in your child's life? How much do you value it? And do your children know that you value it? Because I know that I could probably visit many of your homes, and on the refrigerator door might be posted somebody's drawing or somebody's spelling test or their book report that they got an A on. But where are you celebrating? Where are you communicating that you value friendship? Years ago, I heard Robert Brooks give a talk when I was still working at Schneider Children's Hospital, and he asked a question that changed my parenting. He asked, "What is the first question you ask your children when they come off the bus or come into the house after the school day?" And being a busy working mom, my first question was, "What do you have for homework?" And I realized that communicated that what I value is academics. Our children knew that we valued learning in our home. My husband or I were always with a book or a briefcase filled with learning right at our elbow. But if I didn't ask when they walked in the door, who did you play with? Who did you share with? Who did you make feel welcome today? And how would they know that I also valued their social interactions, that I also thought that that was really important? It's great to communicate that you value this with your children, and you can start doing that with the questions you ask them when they come home and with the conversations you have at your dinner tables, at your Shabbat table, with congratulating them when you see them be a good friend or be friendly. But it's not enough to just value. We have to then think about how do we live this value of welcoming and social interaction. And we have to realize that we are a role model 24/7, 365 days a year, whether we want to be or not. Do our friends, do our children see that when we get the 40th bar mitzvah invitation for the 40th Sunday in a row, we say, Ay, gewalt, another Sunday lost, another Sunday wasted. What does that communicate to our children about how we value friendship and community versus when we say, wow, another Sunday we get to be misameach, to share our simcha, our wonderful celebration with a member of our community. Isn't it wonderful? So we have to think about what we say and how we act in front of our children. I will never forget doing some work in a school around social engagement and around some social dissension in the school. And the school raised the issue that there were a group of girls in the middle school who would call each other up the night before and all decide to wear the same color to school that day. And anyone who didn't get the phone call would be visibly distressed because they were visibly on the outs with the in crowd. When I talked to the faculty about how we might intervene and change this culture, they said, Dr. Novick, do you know that the parents do the same thing when they're going to social events? That there's a group of moms that coordinate their outfits to exclude everyone else. How can we expect the children to behave better than their parents? And it's true, those parents were not living the value. So we've got valuing and we've got teaching, and now is the million-dollar payoff that, believe it or not, we also have to teach this. We have to sometimes directly teach the skills of being a friend. We have to teach our children how to be friendly. In my Eli talk many years ago, I reminisced about my father-in-law, God rest, who taught his four sons how to shake hands, how to make eye contact, how to not have a wishy-washy handshake, because he felt that for in the business world and going on in life, that a handshake was a way you engaged with someone socially. So we have to think about how do we directly teach the skills of being a friend and being a friendly. And this can be done both directly and indirectly, but it's an ongoing process. It's not something that we teach in kindergarten and we stop. Because their friendships are going to be changing all along, we're going to be teaching it all along as well. Can we go to the next slide? Valuing friendships, I've already talked a little bit about this, but just a few other pointers about valuing. Talk about it a lot. Talk about it in your child's life. Talk about it in the books they read. Ask about how characters act in the books. That's a safe way, by the way, to bring in difficult topics, is whether it's the Berenstain Bears that are not being, someone is not being nice to Sister Bear, or whether it is Tom Sawyer, or whether it is Romeo and Juliet. Talk about how people relate socially, and do we think that's okay or not? Plan in advance. Tell your children in advance what your family's etiquette is about going to social events. If we get an invite, we say yes, and we don't ditch someone who we said yes to because we got a better invite. And we don't invite everyone but one child in the class to a birthday party. Tell your children these rules before they need the rules. And certainly celebrate all actions and movement in the right direction. Be really proud of your child when they are a good friend. Next slide. Help define friendships with your children. This is part of valuing it also. Helping children and teens understand that friendship is not ownership, it's not control, and it's not exclusive. And also help our children and teens build their empathy muscles. Ask them to put themselves in somebody else's shoes. What would you want to happen? And how would you feel? By the way, if you ask that in the moment, you will get very bravado answers. I wouldn't care. Doesn't bother me. I'm not a crybaby. That's not the time to develop empathy. The time to develop it is in the calm moments, to say, What would you ever do if this happened to you? How would you feel? And help your child understand the concentric circles of friendship, that the smallest circle are your best friends. A few more are in a close friend circle, but then you can have a very broad circle of classmates and acquaintances, and you can be friendly to everyone in these circles. Next slide. How do we live friendships? How do we, not only by our own example, but for our children, kind of create the luck that allows them to be in the right place at the right time? Well, leverage your social life. Think about the families that you are friendly with, not only to model friendships and friendliness, but to be rather strategic and say, well, if we have that family for a barbecue with that family, and they have children our children's age, and maybe we have a, I don't know, a basketball game set up or a one-on-one, or we do a cooking activity with them, it will allow the kids to interact in a way that promotes social interaction and builds the chance for friendship. We can't force it, but we can create the opportunity. At the same time, we want to structure social family called me once saying, "We don't understand. We invited a child from our son's class for a play date on Shabbos. They live on the other side of town, so they came home with us after services at shul, at the synagogue, and then they were going to pick him up after Shabbat finished, after sundown. This was in the summer. Well, that's about a 9-hour play date. That is a long time for two children to be together and get along. And it's also on Shabbat for families that are observant. It may mean no video games, no TV, etc. It may be the most social interaction demand that you could possibly have. And that's going to be hardest for a child who is shy or who struggles socially. So create a social opportunity like that has low social demand. Taking your child to the movies and inviting a friend has very low social demand. They just have to sit next to each other, maybe share some popcorn, and giggle and laugh at the fun parts in the movie. Maybe after it, have a 5-minute conversation in the car going home. Low social demand. Inviting someone over for an activity where you're, as an adult, engaged. I'm baking cupcakes. Do you want to help me and invite a friend to come over? Again, low social demand, highly structured. So think about as you create the luck, creating opportunities that use only as much social demand as your child can manage at the time. Next slide. Now, we can teach social skills, friendship skills, directly in exactly the same way we teach any other skill. Social skills are teachable and learnable. And just like any other skill, I'll self-reveal here. I think I still don't know my math facts down fact. Down pat. I'm mathematically compromised. But it is teachable and learnable. It just takes me longer than it takes other people. I have a son who's a mathematical wizard, and he knew his math facts somehow intuitively before he could read. And I'm still struggling. So, even though social skills are teachable and learnable by all children, some children are going to learn them like this first time around, and others are going to need a lot of support and repetition. Social skills range from the most basic thing like making eye contact, which it's hard to see on Zoom, but I'm making eye contact with all of you. I'm looking at my camera while I talk, as well as looking down at my slides. I'm looking at Rabbi Hess, who I see on the Zoom. I don't see all of you, but I'm making eye contact. That is one of the most basic of social skills, all the way up. They range to very complex skills like being able to compete in a friendly way, being able to cooperate, being able to give and accept compliments and give and accept criticism, being able to deal with arguments. Those are complex social skills. Temperamental and cultural factors make a difference. New York City public schools got into enormous difficulty because they were demanding, they were punishing children from Hispanic cultural backgrounds for not making eye contact with teachers. When it turns out that in their culture, it's seen as a sign of disrespect for children to look at an elder directly in the eyes. So we do have to think about our children's temperament, the culture they've been raised from, which may influence their social interactions. It does require a lot of practice to master a social skill. Ideally, just like for those of our adults who learn to drive or to ride a bike, you can remember when it was first difficult. You had to think about all the steps and you had to cognitively focus on where do I put the key and where does my foot go on the brake when I start the car. And now you do it without thinking because it has become automatic. We want social skills to become automatic, but to get to that level of automaticity requires a great deal of practice. And just like learning to drive didn't happen in rush hour on one of our major parkways, it happened in a quiet parking lot, devoid of cars and distractions. The place we're going to practice social skills are also going to need to be in the least demanding environments, not in the middle of prom night or some high-stakes social interaction. And keep in mind that the teaching of social skills don't automatically generalize. The fact that I've taught my son or daughter to make eye contact or to have good conversation skills when they're talking to me does not necessarily mean that without some prompting and reminders, they're going to do it when they talk to their peers as well. I see a question about parents and children who are neurodivergent and have a harder time making friends and socializing. Absolutely, we will get to that. I promise I will get to that. Next slide. This is just a sample of social skill progression. We can go to the next slide from easy to more difficult. How do you teach a social skill? Any social skill you're going to teach, whether it's something simple like eye contact, or I'm going to choose playing a game. How do you play a game? You're going to choose 3 to 5 easy rules. My rules for playing a game are know and follow the rules. Wait your turn. I'm trying to remember what's my other. Oh, be a good loser and be a good winner. Those are my 4 rules for game playing. Know and follow the rules. Be a good winner, be a good loser, and wait your turn. By the way, all of you now remember those 4 rules. It's not hard. It doesn't take a lot of drill to get 4 rules into a child or a teen's head. And then I'm going to provide examples and non-examples. What do I mean by be a good winner? A good winner doesn't do a happy dance and say, "Nah, nah, 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 you lost." A good winner says, "Thanks, that was a great game. Want to try again? Want to play again?" And a good loser is someone who doesn't throw the game of checkers across the room and say, "This is stupid. I'm never playing it again." Then I want to provide practice with feedback. If I'm teaching the skill of playing games, and I've done this in my practice many, many times, it's not going to be with Monopoly. It's going to be with Uno because there's a lot of opportunity to practice winning and losing in a quick game of Uno. Monopoly would take me hours. And I'm going to give feedback as we're playing the game, saying, "Wow, you were really good at winning. You did that really nicely. You waited your turn perfectly. No, you're picking up cards for me now. That's not waiting your turn. Remember the rules of being a good game player." So I'm going to give feedback. And I can use videos and books and other sources that can show. Here's an example. I don't think that was good game playing, the way that cartoon character just lost the game. I don't think they were being a good loser. Do you think so? And when I'm teaching social skills is not during a crisis. Now, for neurodivergent children or children who have a harder time socializing, very often they are lacking social skills. And these skills need to be taught over and over and over again. And they may need lots of prompting right before social interactions. You're about to go to the birthday party. Remember, what are the rules for being at the birthday party? What can you expect? What would be the right way? You're going to have be at the lunchroom. What's going to be a good way to start a conversation? Let's practice it. And then right before sending your child off to school, as you're sending them off, a reminder. Remember, I know today's gonna you're gonna do great at lunch because you're gonna remember. What are you gonna remember? Oh yeah. Need reminders. Next slide.
But a question also about the impact of ADHD on social
I'll get to
skills,
it.
making. Okay,
I see
great.
it. I'll get to it. Here's my social skills games. Useful rules for social skills. As you're thinking about teaching a social skill or helping your child master, think about the actions and words that cause problems in a situation and the actions or words that are appreciated by peers. And then the rules come quite naturally. So we know that in playing games, bossing, cheating, having a tantrum, teasing losers, those are the problem behaviors in game playing that will lose friends quite quickly. So appreciated is turn taking, gracious winning and losing, and playing by the rules. So that those they kind of follow naturally, and you can create them. There are also numerous resources online for teaching social skills, endless activities, books, workbooks, etc. Next slide. I've given this already, so we can go to the next one. So this will speak to, and I'll make it specific to ADHD in a moment, but in general, even with non-neurodivergent, even with average children who are reasonably friendly, there are challenges in raising a friendly child, in raising your child to be nice and welcoming and friendly to everyone. Because not every child in their environment is equally easy to be around. Face it, some kids are harder to be friendly to. They're angry, they're irritable, they're distant, they're shy, or in the case of ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, they're impulsive. Do you want a friend who impulsively storms out of the room? Do you want a friend who doesn't easily sit still and follow through in a game? It is harder for those children to, it is harder for children to be friendly to those children. On the other hand, children with ADHD may have wonderful skills, talents, and affinities that make them sought after peers. Again, temperament, which I've talked about, other families' attitudes and actions can make it difficult. You would never host a birthday party and exclude one child, but there may be another parent or parents in the school that are doing that. And we have larger culture issues as well. We have cultural divides in our nation, in our Jewish community, that are only getting more and more challenging. And the reality is that many of our children have limited time for socializing. And much of their time for socializing is still in structured environments. It is in Little League, it is at dance class or ceramics class, it's in after-school activities. There's very little kind of pickup playtime these days. And finally, there's a challenge of technology. I was many years ago, and this is like many years ago, at my nephew's bar mitzvah, and every 13-year-old, and it was a bar mitzvah for kids. It was a sports party with all kinds of sports activities and a DJ and tie-dyeing and everything that a preteen would just want to do. And they were all there on their phones. They weren't talking to each other. They weren't engaging in the activities. They were all texting things. So it is a real challenge. Next slide. I just want to go back to the impact of ADHD, making and keeping friends. One of the things that is really critical for children with ADHD, as well as for all children, by the way, and I don't have a slide for this, but it occurs to me, the question prompts me to think about it, is children understanding their own nature, their own temperament, what they bring to friendships, and both the benefits and the challenges. Too many times I have had children with ADHD tell me what they can't do. I can't do that, Dr. Novick. I can't do my homework. I have ADHD. My response to that is that I'm 5 feet tall on a good day. I can either stand in front of my cabinets and say, I can't reach that, or I can get a stool. I can either say, I can't play basketball, or I can try darn hard. And I've gotten quite good at playing basketball with my kids. Things are harder for me because of this limit, this physical limitation that I live with. But there's nothing I can't do because of this physical limit. They're just things that are harder or that I need help to succeed at. ADHD is the same thing. There is nothing that ADHD excludes from your life. In fact, I would say for most neurodivergent children, it's the same viewpoint that we need to help them grasp that there are things that may be within my grasp, but they're going to take an enormous amount of work or some assistance in order for me to succeed compared to other children. That's okay. For some children with ADHD, the introduction of appropriate treatment, including psychopharmacology and medications, may allow them to be more socially successful. But I've found great success in social skills groups, targeted therapeutic teaching groups that work with a group of children who are having social struggles to master social skills. In terms of books, there are, I'm not sure if your question that you're saying model and teach these skills, there are books that are very obviously skill streaming your adolescent, social skills for your teen. I've never found one that I love. I tend to borrow from various ones. And rather than books, I tend to just Google and find the activities and approaches that I like and pick and choose from different ones, especially knowing the teen and what they're interested in. Every book that is written, every novel that's written for young adults has social issues in it. That's what young adults are interested in. Whether it is a novel about sports, whether it is a horror, whether it is sci-fi, it's still going to have social relationships in it. And again, the advantage of using a novel, you can read the book with your preteen or your teen, read the same book that they're reading, and then talk about, in chapter 10, when Marcy treated Jenny that way, was that okay? What would you do? Did you try, what did you like? What did you not like about how she handled it? What do you think she could do differently? And generally, it is hard to get kids to role play. But see if you can. See if you can. What if we play it out? Let's try it. If I were Marcy, what would you say to me? Or you be Marcy, and I'll try saying something. Tell me how you think it sounds. Do teenagers talk like that? Or am I just being a silly mommy? What do you think? Would this work? In terms of our communal challenge, we have to realize that it takes a village. And we have to sometimes be comfortable reaching out to that village. I know that I had discussions with the friends who had children my children's age, who I was also friendly with, and we had discussions about what would we do if, how would we handle if our child was mean to their child, and how would we want, and would we want to know, and would we want to tell each other? And we had those discussions in advance so that when it did happen, we were kind of prepared. We have to realize that we're a very small, insulated village. It may be for some of our children in some of our schools that their potential peer group is rather limited, that they're not in a public school with the school I told you about before that I consulted to, was a very large suburban public school that had 12 sections of sixth grade, 12 parallel sixth grade classes. That's 250 students. To somewhere in those 250 students, you have to find a friend. I consulted to a family recently where there were 13 girls in their high school class. It's harder to find a friend among 13 when that you only have 12 to choose from, and when you have 250 to choose from. So we have to think about how important it is to help our children be friendly versus being a friend to everyone, but at least to be friendly. That is also a community challenge. I know that there are many children who verbalize, especially teens. I'm afraid if I'm friendly to Marjorie, that she will think that I'm her best friend. She'll glom onto me and I'll be stuck with her. And we have to help our children to navigate that and to be friendly and then to be able to create some space. And it also means that we as a community need to be concerned about the social dynamics in our schools, in our synagogues, on our playgrounds, on our sports teams, in our creative arts programs, even when it doesn't involve our child. Many years ago, when my son, who's one of my sons who's very athletic, was in sixth grade, he came home and asked if he could go on Friday afternoon to the park for a pickup ball game, park around the corner from our house. And I said, sure, you and Brian are going to go, because Brian was his steady Friday afternoon get together. And he said, nope, Brian can't come. Now, if you're the parent of boys, you know that getting information out of boys sometimes takes 12 questions. It's like, you have to be the FBI. Girls talk a lot more and give you a lot more information. Someone was asking about differences between boys and girls. I'll talk about that more in a moment. But he said, no, Brian can't come. I said, his mom won't let him. No, they won't let him. Who's they? The boys. I found out after doing a lot of prying in with my son that there were a group of boys in the sixth grade who created a pickup game on Friday afternoons and decided who got the nod. And this was my son's first invite in, it was probably, I don't know, November, December of the school year. I told him that we don't do that. We don't engage in activities where somebody is banned from coming. It's a public park. Anybody can come and play. He says, but they told me if I bring Brian that I can't come. I said, well, then you have to decide whether you're bringing Brian or whether you're staying at home and playing with him. He opted not to go. And I called around that Friday afternoon to moms in the grade. I would say that of the 10 moms that I connected with, seven of them said, well, my son's included, so I never really thought about it. Two didn't know, and only one was bothered as I was. Now, had I known of the weeks before it involved my child, and here my child wasn't included this week, but it didn't sit well with me. So the happy ending of the story is that I called the my child's sixth grade rabbi at the wonderful school that he attended, and I said, I don't expect you to do anything. I'm just telling you what happened. My son didn't go, and there might be repercussions. He might, be bullied by kids in school today, and I'm just making you aware. I don't expect you to do anything about the Friday problem. The following Thursday, my son came home really excited. He said, guess what? Rabbi Z posted a chart. Come one, come all, Friday afternoons to the park for a ball game. Sign up below. And every Monday for the rest of the school year, Rabbi Z asked the boys how their game was. And he asked, who played first base? Who was on? You know what? Give him a chance. This week, I want to see that he's on first base. He wasn't in the room with them, he wasn't on the ball field with them. And yet, he exerted his authority and his ability to be a social architect to make a real difference in the community of these boys. Boys are very different from girls. girls' friendships are more embedded in long-term historical connections, and they mo get more convoluted. Girls hold grudges for longer. Girls get complex social connections. Boys are much have a much easier time making friendships, dissolving friendships, remaking them, often around sports or athletics, often around, oh, we're having a pickup game. We need another player. Come on, you can play. They're less connected to personality and more connected to, we share this interest. Okay, then you can come. For that reason, by the way, for boys, one of the very important things you can do is develop their sports skills. Nobody needs to be a draft pick for the Yankees or for the Nets. Nobody needs to be a champion ball player. But if throwing a ball and having a catch in the backyard or working on bicycle riding or rollerblading or some physical activity, swimming, will give your child some athletic prowess, some capability, it will help for boys. It makes a difference for boys. In the same way that for girls, having some knowledge of fashion, having some interest in that area when you get to the teen and the preteen years becomes important. It doesn't have to be the end all and be all. And we don't have to change ourselves to make friends, but we have to think about how can I connect with other people? And if my peer group is very interested in X and I have zero interest in that, then I have no point of connection. And so I may need to develop some connection there. Next slide.
One other question that we did have was it to know if you have any comments regarding a threesome when it comes to best friends, specifically for girls, to know if it's a setup for hurt feelings.
So triangles are difficult. Triangles are hard. I think that to some extent it depends on the temperament. Growing up, I had a very clear triangle, but it worked very, very well because everybody knew, both within and beyond the triangle. It started out with two of us. And we were always going to be the pair, the dyad. We included a third one. We welcomed her much of the time, but she was never going to have the same relationship with either of us or with us together that we had. And she accepted that, and that was fine with her. Had she been a different personality, it could have meant disaster. My own children also have been in triangles that naturally evolved and dissolved. Those are boys. For girls, it is more tempestuous and it is difficult. But again, it depends on, do the girls understand that friendship is not ownership, that I can be very close to two people, that I can share my love of fashion with one person and my love of sports with another, and that that's okay. And that, I don't have to do everything with the same one person. Yeah, there's also a really good question. What about when sports are everything to be part of the group and a boy isn't as good? He can't keep up to them but wants to be friendly with them. It's a very, very common issue. And there are boys who become the scorekeeper, who become the team equipment bearer, who get involved in the sport in some way, keep the stats, who become a cheerleader, who, and the truth of the matter is, there is great variability in sports abilities in middle and high school, partly because of male adolescent development has enormous variability. And so in middle school, especially, you find boys that are 4 feet tall and boys that have had their growth spurt and are huge. You hear this voice and this voice both in middle school among boys. And so they have greatly divergent athletic abilities. So you'll find, you may find a place. The nice thing that happens in late middle school and into high school is that other pursuits also become valued and important. Debate team, chess team, academic, what's it called? Trivia team, college bowl, dramatics, art, yearbook, newspaper. And those kids who are not athletic find their niche. It's just before high school, it's really hard, especially for boys. In elementary school, boys speak a language of that basically has a ball in it, Let's play baseball, basketball, football, or a puck, hockey. And for boys who are not athletic, it is a challenge. Again, one unbelievable rabbi in a school that I know, devoted 2 recess periods a week to athletic skills training for boys that he knew needed it. He drilled them on how to catch a football. That's how he spent his recess with boys that he knew this would help them integrate. And sometimes, as parents, we have to also think about what could we do that would help. I do like in terms of a social skills curriculum for middle school, high school, Boys Town has a nice curriculum. Skills Streaming is a reasonable curriculum. Again, I've never found one that is perfect, and many of them are collecting dust on the shelves of school social workers and school guidance counselors, because a social skill curriculum that includes 52 lessons on social skills, it's just not getting done. Schools have too much else on their plate, and it's hard for them to give the time and energy that's needed for that deeply engrossed kind of engaged kind of a program. I've left you some, further information. I'd love to see you join me on my blog. Oh, great question. How do you handle a child who normally gravitates between the bad, the wild, and the mean boys from a young age, 4, 5, 6, 7 years old? So, it's going to sound terrible, but just endless brainwashing repetition about what do we expect? I go again to value, live, and teach. What do we expect? How do we expect you to behave? That's not how boys in our family behave. That is not what mom and dad expect to see from you. This is what we want to see. And in the moment, especially 4, 5, 6, 7-year-old, in the moment, literally as you're dropping it off to the birthday party, what are you going to do? Are you going to make fun of anyone at the bar? Are we going to be not, I can't wait to pick you up and hear that you didn't grab things at the activity, because it will make mom so proud. Constant prompting and emphasizing. Another question. A group of friends dumped a girl when they entered 8th grade. She's devastated, having difficulty making friends in a new high school class. Your thoughts? This is unfortunately too common that as children regroup their social structure, people get left out. In a small high school class, it is particularly challenging. It is not terribly comforting to say to someone in 8th grade, it's not going to always be like this. It will get better. I think that sometimes engaging with the school and letting them know that this is happening and seeing might there be activities planned for the 8th grade that would build community, that would emphasize inclusion, etc. And as much as possible, looking for opportunities for your daughter to have positive social interactions, offering to drive a little further to a ceramics class that might put her in touch with other girls, or if she had a positive camp experience, offering her to Zoom with and talk with her friends from camp on a regular basis, something that keeps her socially positive and engaged. Similar question. Girls' friendship dissolves at the age of 11 over complex issues, and there are bad feelings that remain. The other parents take the position they should work it out for themselves, and the parents' friendship is dissolved. Is there anything that can be done to facilitate everyone using this as a moment of learning? Unfortunately, and I have been called in to consult in cases where schools have been, parents have demanded that a school make two people friends. Well, that can't be. I've been called into cases where parents demand that parents make sure someone is excluded from their child's life. That can't be. We can only ask for reasonable engagement of other parents and of the school. And the bottom line is they have the right to raise their child however they wish. And that may mean that we can't continue to have them in our life. And it's terrible and it's heartbreaking. And you want to think that no one with our values and in our communities would possibly do this. But unfortunately, there are people who will, hold forth that my child matters and nobody else. And my child's happy and I can't force them. And I'm not interested in making this work. I think that Michelle's question about in fourth grade, girls start to form groups and it hurts many, and some groups are excluding, and some girls feel desperate to hold on to friendships. Is this normal? Is there something a school can do? On the one hand, it is kind of normal, but I don't think that it needs to be. I think it's normal because too often, adults allow social interactions to just be Darwinian and survival of the fittest versus owning our power to control social interactions. I told Rabbi before when we were on earlier that I was at a conference of educators, adults, and there were 30 of us together for 4 days. And they said, "You are only going to talk to the people you know unless we assign you seats when we're on the bus. And on certain bus excursions, you're going to be assigned a partner and a topic of conversation." And we all like moaned and groaned, adults, but we did it. And I formed two friendships out of that with people I know I never would have spoken to. I never would have spoken to. And now they're colleagues. So schools could think much more actively about how do we create more open groups. They can't force it, but there are things that they can do. In terms of neurodiversity, I just want to say also that I think we have begun to be much more open with in our communities about this and much more willing to educate students about the fact that there are all kinds of minds in this classroom. There are all kinds of people in this classroom. There are all kinds of personalities. And we have to make every one of them feel part of our class, feel part of our chevra, part of our group. This is our community. And everyone is welcome here, even if they think different, even if they play different, even if they're not as good at sports. Everybody has to be part of the community. We are coming up on having to wrap up. If your kid is just introverted or has social anxiety, it's a continuum. Introverted people, by definition, have some social anxiety. That's why they prefer being on their own. My paradigm is if somebody came to me and said, "All my child eats is pasta," that's it. Noodles of any kind, nothing else. I would say we got to broaden the diet. I don't care that they're happy eating pasta. They have no anxiety about other foods. They just only want pasta. I'm going to have to broaden their diet. It's the same socially. If a child is introverted, we have to broaden their social diet at least a little bit. They don't have to become popular, they don't have to go to every event. But they need to have some social interaction.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Novick, for your enlightening and very helpful presentation. I know I took away so much and I learned so much, and I'm sure that everyone here has learned many things that they're going to apply to their lives and the lives of their children.